And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the next hour and a half, and this is the show on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon that aims to get you thinking and brings Christians and non-Christians together to discuss and debate various aspects of theology, philosophy, history, scripture, and we've got a bit of all of that in today's show. If you want to find out more about the show, then can I encourage you to visit the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And you'll be able to find links from there to many other things like past shows, how to download the podcast of the programme, the various topics that we've covered over the years on this programme, the Unbelievable DVD from our conference back in May this year, and much more besides. That's premier.org.uk/DVD. Right now, though, it's my pleasure to welcome two distinguished guests onto today's programme.
You're unbelievable!
Well, I've been looking forward to today's show immensely because a guest that I've wanted to have on for some time joins me in my studio. He's flown in all the way from the States just for me, obviously. Not really, no. He's here doing lots of other things. But Richard Carrier joins me here in the studio. Richard, well known in the atheist community. His background includes history and philosophy. He's written a great deal on that, spoken a great deal on those issues. And very often comes up in conversations that I have online with atheists and with people in this studio. He's been quoted a number of times. So great to have the man himself with us. Probably most significantly, his name came into the discussion that I had with Bart Ehrman recently in this very studio. And so I'm sure we'll have a little chat about that during the course of today's programme. My other guest, though, on today's show is Mark Goodacre. He's a professor of New Testament at Duke University. And, well, perhaps this gives you a clue about what we're talking about on the show today. It is the historicity of Jesus Christ. And Richard is one of the foremost proponents of what might be called the mythicist view of Jesus, the view that Jesus actually did not exist historically. And we'll be hearing his case for that in today's show. Mark Goodacre doesn't take that view. He doesn't believe that's the best explanation of the evidence we have before us. He says Jesus did exist. We can quibble about the what actually happened in those stories and all the rest of it, but the fact that there was a Jesus of Nazareth isn't really in dispute. So we're going to hear from Mark as to why he holds to that view and hear the interaction today. So first of all, welcome along, Richard. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Well, you've just literally stepped off a plane.
Literally, yes.
into the studio. So we've got you at your your most depleted and
all the way from California. California, it's the worst, right?
It is. That's an 8-hour time difference, isn't it? So this should be easy for Mark today. but seriously, you've been kind of at the forefront of this particular view of on the historicity of Jesus for some time. What got you into this whole area, though, to start with? Maybe we should start there.
I actually started where Dr. Goodacre is. I thought it was a ridiculous notion that certainly the consensus, the overwhelming consensus, is that Jesus existed. And usually as a historian, you would just presume historicity. That's usually the default position, and you would need a really good case to argue otherwise. And then several people kept insisting that I needed to read Earl Doherty's book, The Jesus Puzzle. And they said, no, this is you, and I keep saying, I've read some of these mythicists, authors. They're crappy arguments, usually, in my opinion, and not even worth reading. He says, a lot of people whose opinion I respected said, no, you really need to read this one and tell, because we want to know, it looks like it's legit. I mean, what do you think? Because you have a PhD in ancient history, you should know. And so I said, yeah, all right, okay, I'll do this. I'll do one. I figured I'd do one review of it, and that would be the end of it. Mm-hmm. But I found his case isn't perfect. It's not flawless. But that book makes the most persuasive case, I think, that I had ever seen. And he actually had at least enough to make it plausible to argue. Like, it wasn't ridiculous. And that made me think, because a lot of the things he pointed out is that the case for historicity is often based on fallacious arguments and speculations, just as much as mythicism is. And so after that, that's what got me into thinking it, and I sort of declared myself an agnostic at that point. I says, well, I don't think he's proven his case, but I also think he's proven that the historicity defenders have not proven their case as well, and so someone needs to do this properly. And then there came a point when I was buried in student loans, and I went to my fans on my blog and said, I'll do any project you want if you can help me, if we can get money together and pay off my student loans. And that's what they did. They said, oh, we want you to do the definitive book on the historicity of Jesus. We want you to do that. And it's like, oh, okay. And it was unanimous. Like, they really wanted to. Mm. And they got together $20,000.
Wow. That's significant.
Yeah. Mm. So I treated that like a research grant. We went through a nonprofit organization so they could get charitable deductions for their donations to make this happen. And so I've taken it as a serious research project that I've basically received grant money to complete. And so I've been working on that. And the book that I just came out this year, Proving History, which is the subtitle is Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus, is the first fruit of that research project. Mm. And then the next fruit will come out next year, and that's on the historicity of Jesus Christ, which will actually lay out the case that we'll be talking about today.
And you were highly critical of Bart Ehrman's recent book this year.
I was, yes.
Did Jesus Exist? The Case for...
It was a profoundly disappointing book to
me. Well, yes, and you said as much in your blogs and online, and there was something of a to and fro between you.
Yeah.
Now, Bart came in this studio to talk about that book earlier on in the year. We didn't have you on the line. It would have been nice to maybe got you guys together to talk about that. But he, one of the things he said was that he just felt that your position was largely, or the mythicist position in general, perhaps he didn't reference you at this specific point, was kind of coming from a very anti-theistic viewpoint, that there was a kind of a prior kind of bias going on here, that somehow getting rid of the historical Jesus will kind of get rid of Christianity, which will be a good thing in the long run.
I don't think anyone should actually honestly think that would happen. But anyway, I mean, there's a number of things wrong with that. I mean, first of all, I was a hardcore, outspoken atheist and critic of Christian apologetics and so forth for many years while being a historicist. So mythicism wasn't really my way of attacking Christianity. I was actually against mythicism for a very long time. It was the evidence and the argument that convinced me of that. So my motivation is not to attack Christianity with it. In fact, I think it makes attacking Christianity more difficult, because in terms of the logic of cognitive science and the logic of argument and persuasion, it's easier to agree with a person on as many things as possible and then show that they're wrong.
Right. Yeah, if you're trying to dissuade someone, saying Jesus didn't exist is not going to help your case necessarily.
If you actually want to deconvert people, or at least get them out of this religion and start thinking rationally and secularly about ethics and politics, defending mythicism is not the way to go to do that. The only reason I'm defending it is because I find it to be a persuasive case, and it's something that I think needs more attention in the scholarly community, even if ultimately it gets refuted. And then we can actually show why mythicism is false without using the sort of straw man arguments that people like Bart Ehrman have been doing.
Well, obviously, if you want to respond, Bart, you're welcome to. But this has been laid out in a number of online areas, and it wouldn't take long for you to find out more detail on that if you want to go looking for it. But let's introduce our other guest on today's program, Mark, who joins us from Duke University, where he's Professor of New Testament. Mark, thank you for being with us today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into doing New Testament studies?
Sure. Well, I suppose I've done it. I was a student in Oxford and studying theology there, and I was always fascinated by the New Testament. I think that was the thing that really drew my interest in. And I'm just one of those few lucky people around that have managed to make it their career to do what some people, can only do for a hobby, which is read books all day and write about things and teach it. And one element in all of that is the historical Jesus. I think in some senses, it's one of the toughest issues in New Testament criticism. And for that reason, some people just leave it to one side. It is a minefield. And so to some extent, I have sympathy with all the kind of difficulties that Richard is already having to face in his quest, because it is a dense subject, not least because there is so much written on it. Mm. I mean, nobody, no sane human being could actually manage to read all of the books that have been written on the historical Jesus in the last 50 years, let alone the last couple of hundred years, you know. But yeah, I come to it just because it's an enthusiasm. But yes. luckily, one that I actually get paid for.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's always handy, isn't it?
Oh, it's marvellous.
I mean, as I mentioned, some people suggest that the mythicist view is propelled to some degree by a kind of anti-theistic viewpoint. Now, I know that you've written and talked about the fact that you're very keen to not allow a faith position to particularly... bias your historic coming to historical texts as a historian, but inevitably we all come with some kind of presuppositions to the material we have, don't we? And I mean, how does that work out for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's important to do in any kind of scholarship is face up to your own prejudices, be honest about your biases, and talk about, you know, the way that you're looking at the kind of prior things that you're bringing with you. So I think that's inevitable. But at the same time, I think the more self-conscious you are about your own particular biases and your own particular background, your own particular context, the better a historian you can be. So, you know, I mean, history is about dialogue. It's about talking to one another. It's about kind of working through some of these issues. And at the end of the day, the most important thing is getting the evidence on the table, looking at what we've actually got. So, you know, when we're talking about these things, I don't really particularly care what people's theistic beliefs are or not. I mean, Bart Ehrman, you've mentioned a couple of times. I mean, he's a well-known, he describes himself as a happy agnostic. And I mean, he's just down the road from me here at Duke at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he came almost reluctantly to this question just because people kept kind of bending his ear about it, you know.
Mm. Well, let's talk about this then. And I should say at this point, if you're listening and you'd like to contact the show and give us your thoughts on our discussion today on whether Jesus really existed, I'd welcome them. Your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's the email address. And if you want to get in touch via the Twitter account, @unbelievablejb is where to go to send me your thoughts and say hello. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the Facebook page. And all those links and past shows and much more besides available from the webpage of this programme, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And you can find all kinds of other information with the podcast of today's programme on my guests. I'll obviously post some links to both Mark Goodacre and indeed Richard Carrier's website so that you can find out more about what they do. Perhaps we should start with you, though, Richard. This is a massive area, and we're trying to condense it into a half an hour, 40 minutes, say, of talking through it. But can you kind of give us the bare bones of what your thesis is about Jesus and exactly why you don't believe he actually existed?
Yeah, but let me qualify that. First of all, I don't think we can be certain one way or another. I do think that the propensity or the preponderance of evidence supports mythicism. But I think the evidence for the origins of Christianity is so scarce and so problematic that we can never have that kind of certainty that I think some people want. Both mythicists and historicists want this kind of this certainty that I don't think we can have. Nevertheless, that caveat aside, yeah. I do think there is a mythicist theory that makes better sense of the evidence we have. And is at least even if you don't think that far, even if you don't follow me to that extent, it's at least plausible. So it's not ridiculous.
Okay, not so left field that it's out of the ballpark kind of thing.
But there are mythicist theories that are out of left field.
Okay,
you could have to do a whole show on just those. And it's important to mention that because if you were to go into this now, if someone were to just start researching Jesus myth theory, especially if you were to Google it. Most of the stuff you'd find is just terrible or absurd or ridiculous beyond, even in print as well, not just online. And so there are a lot of these wild conspiracy theories. Even Earl Doherty, I think, he starts with a really plausible core case, but then he just piles on a lot of speculations and additional theories about what he thinks happened, which I think go beyond the evidence.
Okay.
And so there are mythicists like that. And to me, I just want to get down to the core basic theory. And this is the way I would put it is there's only one defensible, plausible theory that Jesus didn't exist. And this is the view that Christianity began with revelations, actual or purported, of a divine being named Jesus who underwent a death and resurrection in the heavens, essentially in the lower heavens, and preached through revelations. And if you look at the letters of Paul, Paul never refers to Jesus having a ministry. He never refers to anyone seeing or meeting him while he was alive. He only talks about people receiving revelations of Jesus. And that's what made you an apostle. It's made someone an apostle was having a revelation of the Christ. So if you start with that theory, like you say, okay, let's posit that and then presume that the Gospels and so forth are a typical kind of mythologization of a demigod, of a celestial being called euhemerization, which happened a lot in the ancient world, where you start with a celestial worshipped god and then he gets placed on earth in a particular time of history and biographies are written about him. Romulus is an example of this. Osiris is another. So these things did happen. So the question is it what happened to Jesus? And so that you have these two possible competing theories, that there was a charismatic man at the start of it, or there was this revelatory being at the start of it. And then so is it the revelatory being who became historicized, or is it the historical being who became mythologized? You know, this one way or another, I think any mainstream scholar agrees there's a great degree of mythology that has surrounded Jesus by the time we get to the Gospels. So that much we have agreement on. It's just a question of how much. Is it 100% mythology, or is it, you know, 90% or whatever?
Well, I mean, obviously there would be a whole nother show on for those who didn't take a historical perspective, but who did take a historicity perspective, but then disagreed on exactly how much fact we have in the Gospels as opposed to mythology.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But in this instance, we're just kind of, trying to dear down on the very simple question of whether it was a completely mythological being to begin with in that sense. So that's the general outline of the thesis there, Mark. I mean, any initial comments just on
well, this? The thing about bringing up Paul is that Paul really is some of our best evidence for the historical Jesus. I mean, he's writing within a generation of Jesus existing. I mean, he's there in the early years of the Jesus movement, and it's very clear from his epistles he's talking about a real human being. I mean, he refers to him being descended, you know, from the seed of David, and he talks about him being born of a woman. He refers on several occasions to different things in his ministry. I mean, the thing is, Paul's taking this stuff for granted. It's very difficult to see lots of this stuff in Paul's epistles as being talking about some kind of figure that began life as a sort of cosmic mythological being. I mean, the it's not just Jesus either. I mean, Paul knows loads of people from that early Christian movement, people like Peter, people like James, the brothers of Jesus, the 12. He regularly visits Jerusalem. I mean, he knows these people and talks with them. He didn't meet Jesus himself in the flesh, and that was a cause of great anxiety to Paul. I mean, if Jesus had never appeared in the flesh, then Paul wouldn't have to have any of that sort of great stress that he has, that he never actually met Jesus. I mean, his big battle in early Christianity is with people who knew Jesus in the flesh. And so Paul has to say, hey, look, you know, I'm not in the least inferior to you lot. You know, you super apostles, you know, I'm still, you know, important in my own right. So Paul is really very good evidence for the existence of a historical Jesus.
Before you come back in with that, and I'm sure you will want to, Richard, I mean, one of the examples that I think is sometimes given, certainly Bart Ehrman gave when he came on the program, was a sort of throwaway comment in one of Paul's letters referencing James, the brother of Jesus, which, in his opinion, he said, just wouldn't make any sense if you didn't have a historical person to tie that to. It just wouldn't make sense within that context to sort of make a comment like this.
I think that's right. I mean, he refers to James several times. I mean, Galatians 1 and 2, 1 Corinthians 15. He also refers to the brothers of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 9. He refers repeatedly to this character called Kephas or Peter that is also known to us, you know, from the Gospels. I mean, Paul lives and moves with these people who spent time with Jesus.
And so it seems like too absurd to suggest that somehow they're all under some kind of common colluding together to create a sort of historical person out of a mythological beginnings.
Yeah, I don't. If someone were to propose that, I think that would be a much less plausible hypothesis. But I think it's already presuming too much. You're sort of importing the gospel notions into the epistles. Because, for example, Paul never refers to Peter as a disciple. There are no disciples in Paul's letters. He never uses the word. They're all apostles. And Dr. Goodacre refers to this Paul exhibiting anxiety about not having met Jesus. That's actually not in the epistles. That's not there. For example, we have the exact opposite in the epistle to the Galatians, where Paul goes out of his way to insist that he wasn't relying on any human tradition, that he only knows what he knows through direct revelation from Jesus, and that he didn't even talk to the other apostles for many years, in fact.
Well, it's because he's been challenged by the other early Christians about his credentials. I mean, and it's clear if you look across...
Well, we don't know what that challenge was. That's the thing, is that you can...
Well, we have a pretty good idea.
One assumption or the other. That's the thing, is that there could be a number of different possible causes of that same particular battle. And it seems clear that Paul is actually gaining... He's trying to argue that his authority comes from the fact that he saw Jesus in a revelation. And he doesn't actually refer to there being an actual contest. For example, it would be great if Paul said, you know, some people have accused me of misrepresenting Jesus because Peter actually knew Jesus and he said this, that, and the other. If we had something like that in the authentic epistles of Paul, that would be pretty much very clear, undisputable evidence for the historicity of Jesus.
What we have in places like 1 Corinthians 15 is he sets out what he has received from those who were in Christ as he describes it before him. And, you know, he sets out this case and says that he had shared that with the Corinthians as of first importance. The reason he gets into arguments later on in places like Galatians is because you've got people like Peter and James who are making a big deal of their authority within the early Christian movement. They're the sort of so-called pillars, as it were. But it's very clear that Paul, at least in the early stage of his mission, is kind of deferring to these people and sharing traditions that they had passed on about Jesus, and that they're traditions that only really make good sense of a human being on earth, someone who, you know, died for starters. You know, I mean,
there is this one thing that often comes up when I speak with those who perhaps question the historicity of Jesus and Paul's account, is that he mentions very few events from the life of Jesus. He doesn't mention a virgin birth and those kinds of stories from the Gospels. He it's very bare. Obviously, he talks about the death and resurrection of Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that any kind of give more weight to the argument?
I think the problem with that is it's kind of reading too canonically. I mean, we read canonically because the Gospels are in the New Testament first. But actually, if you begin with Paul, it's amazing how much stuff he tells you about Jesus. I mean, he talks about his descent from David at the beginning of Romans. He talks about him being born of a woman. He talks about his teaching on specific things like divorce in 1 Corinthians 7, about his teaching on mission in 1 Corinthians 9. He mentions his family on several occasions. He talks about his other disciples. He talks about his teaching on apocalyptic in 1 Thessalonians. I mean, there's actually a surprising amount there. It's just that we're seduced into thinking there's not so much there because we are so much more familiar a lot of the time with the Gospels than we are with the epistles.
Well, it's all of those things, though, actually have explanations. They can actually be explained on the mythicist theory. For example, he doesn't talk about Jesus being executed by Pontius Pilate. He doesn't even refer to anyone, you know, he doesn't refer to any particular historical event when he was crucified. And that's the Doherty thesis. So if you're going to compare the two theories, the theory is that this death and resurrection occurred in the lower heavens, and we have other examples of this happening. For example, there were groups of Osiris worshippers who also thought Osiris was died and resurrected in the lower heavens. So this idea that this can happen...
He refers to Judea, doesn't he? He refers to the Judeans in 1 Thessalonians 2. I mean, that's not the lower heavens. This is people that were moving around with Jesus in Judea. It's a historical place. I've been there.
Well, no, but Paul doesn't say that it happened in Judea. That's the thing. That's why the evidence we have can be explained by either theory. And so that's where we have to actually look at the two theories and see which one explains all the evidence better. And so we don't have anything that clear cut. For example, I mean, you mentioned that Paul said he received his tradition from those in Christ before him. That's not in the epistles of Paul. Paul never says that he received the tradition from those in Christ before him.
Yes, 1 Corinthians 15.
He only says he received it from... 3. He very adamantly says he received it only from Jesus in a direct revelation.
No, no.
In fact, he uses the exact same words.
Let's just allow Mark to respond there. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, 1 Corinthians 15 clearly sets out that he says, you know, that he'd received these traditions from those that were in Christ before him, and he passed it on to the Corinthians as a first importance.
I'm pretty sure how it's worded. I can actually look that up if we want.
Well, look it up. I mean, I suppose the question as well that strikes me, Richard, is, I mean, what do you think Paul was doing? Was he kind of, was he trying to sort of at that point, in your theory, make a historical Jesus from the heavenly Jesus? Or was he only having in mind the heavenly Jesus?
Yeah, I think when
you
we're
really
looking...
think that, that everything Paul wrote about Jesus, he was just talking about a sort of spiritual Jesus, not a flesh and bone walking
spiritual
the earth.
Spiritual is misleading, but I mean, he thought he was a real being, right? So he's having these revelations of this celestial being, and he did think he really did take on flesh, and that flesh really did die, and that he was resurrected in a new superior body. All of this happened in the exact same way that, for example, Osiris worshippers and Romulus worshippers and so on also thought these things, that these demigods would die.
Well,
and
in
rise
a sense,
so
that's
on.
What all Christians believe, that Jesus was a spiritual being and then incarnated as Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah, and the mythicists...
But you're saying that's not what Paul was actually saying. We've somehow read our own interpretation into Paul there.
Yes and no, because the best mythicist theory, the one that's defensible in my opinion, does agree with the basic idea that Paul believed that Jesus assumed flesh, that flesh assumed the character of Davidic royalty, and that he did die, and that, you know, and that he did rise from the dead. It's just this all occurred in a spiritual realm, which is to them was a real cosmological realm. It wasn't an idea.
Okay.
It wasn't an abstract concept. And he knows this through revelation. And here, let's, for example, I'll quote 1 Corinthians 15, verse 1, moving forward. Brethren, I declare unto you the gospel which I preached unto you, which also you have received, and wherein you stand, but which also you are saved, if you keep in memory what I preached unto you, etc., etc. For I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received. And then he just goes on to describe the gospel, how that Christ died for our sins, and so on. That's the exact same wording. Then you look in the book of Galatians, and Galatians 1, he says, you know, what I passed on to you is what I received, and I only received it by revelation from
Okay,
Jesus.
So you're saying that then in that context, what he's received has just been a direct revelation, and he's not doing what Mark claims, he's been talking to the people around Jesus.
That's right. He denies in Galatians getting this from human
tradition.
Well, in fact, it looks clear that he doesn't believe human tradition is reliable, or that the Galatians would have trusted human tradition. He's saying, I got it through a revelation direct from Jesus. And
let's allow Mark to respond then. Mark, he said...
I mean, Paul's letters are occasional, so you have to sort of look at each one in its own right. 1 Corinthians 15, what he's doing is he's setting out very clearly the tradition that he has received. As soon as he speaks about this receiving of tradition, he goes on to mention, first of all, Peter, and then on to James. So these are the people that we know that he went to talk to in Jerusalem from early on. When we get to Galatians, what his problem is that he's wanting to stamp his authority on the gospel that he's been preaching. So he has to say, look, I've got this gospel from God. But of course, the content of what he's picked up is from those who were in Christ, as he describes it before him. That's how he kind of sets up these things. So, you know, I mean, it's quite often a case that we have to take seriously the way in which Paul is addressing a particular congregation, a particular community. But 1 Corinthians 15 especially is pretty rich in Jesus tradition. And I think what happened is that a little earlier in Paul's career, he is much more inclined to use Jesus tradition. A little later, he has to be a little bit more careful because, you know, he's been challenged on some of these things, and Peter is becoming more of a popular person, you know, in some of these communities, and people are going, hey, what would Peter say about this? So he has to sort of, you know, rein back a little bit and stress that he's getting things from God. But I think it's pretty clear that this is where he's going.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll get right back into it after a short break. You're listening to a program, and we've done this issue a few times in the course of the history of this program. Did Jesus exist? Well, I have in the studio with me probably the premier, what you might term, mythicist in the world, Richard Carrier, who has a new book out and another one to follow as well on why he believes Jesus wasn't actually a historical person. Well, on the line from Duke University is Mark Goodacre, a New Testament historian there, and he's making the case for the historical Jesus, as we've been hearing. We'll be back in a couple of moments' time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Okay, folks, so I'm just...
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. We're talking about whether Jesus really existed, and that's the controversial claim from Richard Carrier, and he's at the forefront of what's sometimes been called the mythicist view, that Jesus actually never existed. His latest book on proving history, Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus, aims at starting to set that out, and there's another one to follow in the year to come. So while he's with us here in the studio, I thought we'd get Mark Goodacre on the phone from Duke University. He's a professor of New Testament there and has been making the case for the historical Jesus. And the main sticking point in that last section, gentlemen, it just seemed to be that, as far as Mark's concerned, the references Paul makes just can't be attributed to him believing in some kind of purely spiritual in heavenly realms Jesus character, when so many of the references he seems, throwaway references even, seem to reference historical people who knew Jesus. But you're adamant, Richard, that these references can all be seen through the mythicist lens as somehow simply at the end of the day talking about a Jesus in the historic, in the sort of heavenly realms.
Yeah, that's the correct way to put it, that you can explain it both ways. And that's because, for example, Paul never says Peter met Jesus, for example. Peter came first. That was the problem, that the 12 and the other apostles preceded Paul. And so they had the prior authority. That's the problem.
But when
them.
He talks about
but he never,
Peter,
he never, the debate between them is never, well, he knew Jesus personally. That never comes up in their debate.
There's different
ways to explain this, and that's the key thing. Is that Peter was first, but first what? He was the first receiver of revelation, and that's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, you know, Jesus was, according to scriptures, he died and rose again. And then he was seen by Peter and the 12 and so on. So there's no reference to them seeing him before he died, or seeing him in a ministry, or being his pals, or being picked by him, for example, while he was still alive. That's not in there. That's never mentioned in Paul.
Because,
now, it's possible Paul's deliberately
Paul's
avoiding
talking
all
about
this,
resurrection in that
but
chapter.
That's still, that's an explanation.
I mean, so of course he's not
going to,
Paul hasn't got this, you know, he's not going to have pause to say, oh, and by the way, I'm just going to tell you the parable of the sower, or, you know, I mean, the point of 1 Corinthians 15 is it's occasionally he's talking about the issue of resurrection. So that's what he's focused on. But what we do as historians is we have to have a look at what people give away in passing. And what he gives away in passing there is his knowledge of an early Christian movement that was focused on someone who died, you know, and then these characters who do appear elsewhere in Paul's epistles, who Paul has had personal conversations with in Jerusalem, you know. So
yes, that's true. But these are the first apostles. These are the first to receive the revelations of the Jesus, according to the myth theory. That's the mythicist theory.
Mm-hmm.
There's no clear case where Paul gives it away as one or the other, for example. That's the key thing, is that you're importing the sort of canonical assumptions.
I mean, if I was coming to this having never read the Gospels, and my first interaction with the story of Jesus was reading Paul's letters, would I really come away thinking, oh, he's only referencing a sort of heavenly character here?
It strikes me
that he says enough to make you think, oh, yeah, there was stuff happened that he's talking about, and it happened in real life.
But he doesn't really. I mean, it's all sort of this sort of abstract mythological concepts of dying and rising. There's no specific details, for example, like the being born of a woman, but he doesn't, you know, say born of Mary in a particular time, for example. He says, you know, of the seed of David, but he didn't say how he knows that.
Well, dying isn't abstract and mythological to Paul. I mean, dying is something that he talks about all the time as happening in his own communities. And the interesting thing is, he often links death and resurrection of people in his own communities with the death and resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't make any sense to sort of be appealing to this death of Jesus and the sufferings of Jesus that Paul feels that he shared in, if these sufferings haven't actually taken place on earth. The whole point of
Paul
sharing
place,
Jesus' sufferings is that
in,
these are
in
things
the
that he has...
Let's give you an example. This is a more concrete piece of evidence. We have a second century, probably originally first century document called The Ascension of Isaiah. And it's been multiply redacted by Christians. And we can tell that one piece of it that has the sort of stock gospel in it with Pontius Pilate and all that was added later, because in the ascension of Isaiah is taken up into heaven, and this angel tells him what he's going to see in the first section, and in the next section he sees it. But it's in that section that we have this sort of gospel inserted. But when we see what the angel explains to him, he says that Jesus was a pre-existent being who's going to descend, assume a body, and that the devil, Satan, and his demons are the ones who are going to crucify and kill him in the firmament, in the lower heavens. And then he rises there, and then he's seen of the angels and Satan and his demons, and so see that he is the new resurrected Christ. So we have an example here that has to be explained either as this was the original teaching that evolved over time, or later Christians adopted the celestial Jesus view and took Jesus out of history. So it has to be one or the other. And then, of course, later Christians then doctored the second half of this by putting the historical Jesus into it. But when you look at the first section of this, it's clear.
Why, on your view, would they have done that? I mean, let's entertain the hypothesis, mm-hmm. okay. Why would Christians, who started off believing they had a revelation of Jesus as a mm-hmm. heavenly figure, then want to make him a historical figure?
You could ask that question of all the other gods in antiquity, because the exact same thing was done after God after God after God. You start with a celestial deity or this abstract spiritual deity that is then euhemerized. He's put on earth given a historical time. So if you want to know, like, what are the possible reasons why they would do that? We know they were doing it. One of the possible reasons is argued by Kurt Knoll in a chapter in Is This Not the Carpenter, edited by Thomas Thompson and Thomas Varana. Kurt Knoll is a professor of religion, and he writes this chapter arguing, essentially, I can't remember the exact title, but it's something like Explaining Christianity Without a Jesus, basically without a historical Jesus.
Okay.
And he says there's a polemical and sort of basic natural selection advantage to a church that packages its deity as a historical deity and creates a physical tradition that it can trace back. So creating this idea that Peter knew Jesus personally and then passed it on as a human tradition is rhetorically useful.
Let's allow Mark to come in here. Go ahead, Mark.
I think one of the problems with this view is that actually early Christians, and this isn't just Paul, actually had a lot of trouble explaining to people about the crucifixion. I mean, Paul says at one point that the idea of a crucified Messiah is something that is a stumbling block to his fellow Jews, a scandalon to his fellow Jews. And the thing is, it's not something that they're kind of manufacturing. This is something that they spend lots of the time attempting to explain. It's kind of embarrassing to them at first. And in fact, Paul himself, who persecuted that early Christian movement, presumably persecuted it largely because they were coming out with this preposterous idea that the Messiah was going to be crucified. So what they do is that they're working with a tradition, with something that they're repeating that is actually to lots and lots of people something that they find kind of horrifying. And the thing that's horrifying about it is the idea that the Messiah in history, on earth, in the recent past, was crucified, which was something they knew about. They knew about crucifixion and were horrified by it. And the idea that the Messiah would go through that was particularly horrifying.
It's a kind of what you might call the criterion of embarrassment, which is often used in historical Jesus studies for suggesting that it doesn't make sense for them to, if they're manufacturing a story, put details in which should just make their story all the harder to believe. And that goes back to things like women discovering the empty tomb and things like that. But I'd also be interested in hearing your perspective, Mark, on whether in your view, in that context of Judaism at that time in at the place, that this would have been a likely thing to happen. It may have happened in pagan cultures, what Richard's describing of a mythological god being given a historical nature. Would that have been likely to happen in Judaism at that time?
I think that's a good question, and I think this is one of the things that make the Gospels themselves quite interesting to read. We've talked a lot about Paul, we haven't talked so much about the Gospels, but if you take Mark's Gospel, for example, Mark spends much of his time trying to explain that, in spite of all appearances to the contrary, this idea of a crucified Messiah isn't that balmy. And that's really lots of what it... And the thing is, he even depicts the disciples, people like Peter that we know from later Christianity as well, he depicts them as going, surely this can't be right. Surely, you can't get crucified. Surely you can't suffer and so on. And so I think, you do have this feeling that it is a bit against the grain. It is kind of troubling. And the early Christian gospel was always that struggle with this great paradox that they were claiming that Jesus was God's special anointed one, but that his destiny wasn't what lots of people thought it should be. I mean, for a start, he doesn't ever become king and start reigning. His things are kind of cut off before he even gets to the point of establishing his new reign.
And so it's that kind of old thing, Richard, of if you're going to make up a story, right, don't make up this one, because it's going to be really hard to sell to people at the end of the day in that time and culture. So wouldn't it have made more sense if they were going to do what you're suggesting they did, that they wouldn't have had him being crucified and
not necessarily
rising again and all that sort of thing. Because
creating absurd, embarrassing, paradoxical religion was very common at the time. To take an exact analogy, we have the god Attis, right? The god Attis died through castration. And in honor of this, his priests castrated themselves. And castration was one of the most humiliating things. It was a very despicable kind of idea, from especially among the Roman and Greek elite, the idea that you would emasculate yourself. And yet they went around preaching this religion that they're worshiping an emasculated god who castrated himself, and that priests, if you want to become a priest, you have to castrate yourself. So this is not an argument for there actually having been an Attis who actually castrated himself. It's an example of how religions often preach these things that are paradoxical because they have a sort of emotive value. Like, once you can get someone to believe this, you can sort of get them into a whole system of theology that's based on the suffering of the god. And there's a lot of different examples of these different demigods who underwent some sort of great ordeal or suffering. Many of them do die and rise from the dead, but many of them just undergo great struggles, and it's always called suffering. It's a passion. The exact same word is used. And through this suffering, they acquire power over death, and by sharing in that, the believer can also acquire power over death and become saved, essentially. Christianity is exactly copying a model of this kind of religion, where this personal salvation cult that existed in many different forms before this occurred. But this idea of the argument from embarrassment is multiply problematic for this reason and many other reasons. And in Proving History, which is the one book you can get now, I have an extensive section on that. So if you actually want to see how the mythicists would respond to the entire gamut of argument from embarrassment arguments, including the crucifixion argument, that's the place to look, and you could do a whole show just on that.
Well, we have talked about it before in other contexts and other shows. But Mark, I guess the question I'm left with is, does it seem plausible in what you know about literature at that time and in that place, and the type of literature that comprises those early Gospels of Mark and so on, that this could be seen as a historicization of a spiritual thing that someone had come up with some time before? I mean, does it strike you as plausible, quite apart from these issues around Paul's references?
Yeah, I find it extraordinarily difficult to grasp historically. I think it's a very difficult case to make. I mean, not least because we know quite a lot about Judaism from this period. It's not like Christianity just suddenly emerges in some great vacuum. So we know what kind of people like Paul and Peter and James, we know what kind of people they were. We know how lots of Jews in this period thought. That's why when we get this stuff that they're telling us about Jesus, we can actually get a good idea that they're not just kind of randomly making this stuff up, because we have an idea how Jews in this period thought. We know how lots of Jews reacted to the way that the early Christian movement talked as well. I mean, just to sort of tag something about the criterion of embarrassment, I share some of Richard's caution about this criterion. I don't think that ultimately the early Christians were embarrassed by what they were preaching. I mean, they basically were claiming that Christ died for our sins and so on. They weren't embarrassed by that. And lots of the things that scholars claim they're embarrassed by, clearly they weren't, because they were all saying it. And if I'm embarrassed about something, I tend not to confess it, too sort of openly. So I think it's not that. What it rather is they're conscious of the fact that other people know that it sounds odd. So when people like Paul talk about Christ crucified, and when Mark in his gospel constructs the gospel around the idea of a Christ crucified, they know it sounds weird. They know it sounds strange to other people. And the reason they know that is because they're Jews engaging in discussion together with its own sort of shared presuppositions and shared background and so on. And that's why I think the idea of a sort of mythicist Jesus is so difficult to get one's head round, because we actually have some idea how Jews in this period thought about these things.
Well, I think that's actually somewhat misleading, because in fact there were dozens of different Jewish sects that were very diverse, and we know almost nothing about most of them. So I think it's an argument from ignorance to say that because we know certain Jews, especially primarily the rabbinical Jews, what they thought, or the Qumran Jews, what they thought, that therefore we know what all Jews thought. And I think that's very dangerous thing.
We don't really, because
there's a lot of diversity there, and more diversity than we are aware of, in fact. So we can't really launch from arguments like we know what all Jews would think at the time.
No, we don't know what all of them thought, but we have a good idea what lots of them thought. And that's and to understand the early Christian movement, we have to understand it as one of those sects within Judaism. And one of the elements that Christians like Paul shared with other people, like, say, Pharisees and like the Qumran community, the Dead Sea Scrolls community, is they believed in resurrection of the body. And the whole point of that there is that the human being actually dies on earth first. So what it means is we can get our heads around certain things that lots of Jews in this period thought. And once we get our heads around that, it's much easier to understand how it is that Jesus fits into that picture.
Well, just to give an example of how diverse Jewish views could be, for example, we have the life of Adam, where Adam is actually buried in heaven, for example. So there's this unusual concept that you can actually have dirt and earth and buried in heaven. I mean, these kinds of – there's a lot of different views that you can find. If we, and this idea also of the ultimate sacrifice, if you read Hebrews 9, and just – if that's all you knew, for example, about Christianity – the theology of Hebrews 9 makes perfect sense within Judaism. It's this idea. It's essentially of completing the Isaac sacrifice. Now, if you imagine there was a Jewish sect, let's pretend for a moment that there was a Jewish sect in which Isaac was actually sacrificed, that Abraham went through with the sacrifice, and that sacrifice gave people salvation, and therefore people went around worshiping the heavenly Isaac, right, who was sacrificed by this. That would make sense within Judaism. And Christianity is essentially just that. This Jesus is supposedly the sort of ultimate Isaac, because in the Abraham and Isaac story, an animal is substituted for Isaac, and in Jewish tradition, this was the original Yom Kippur, in a sense, the original atonement sacrifice that procured, it washed people of their sins. But it had to be repeated every year, because an animal sacrifice doesn't have the mojo of a human sacrifice. But if you want the most powerful magical sacrifice that you can get, what do? You sacrifice God's one and only son. It makes sense theologically within a certain mindset. I mean, you can imagine a sect of Jews
I could imagine also that Hebrews, of all the letters, perhaps supports your case. We get a lot of language there of Jesus entering into the heavenlies and all the rest of it. But obviously that we're not in any sense obliged to see that as Paul writing that letter.
But even there with Hebrews, I mean, the argument works on the basis that Jesus has been tempted and the believer has gone through trials, but none of them as great as the trials through which Jesus has gone. So the writer of Hebrews compares the way that the contemporary Christian lives with the way that Jesus lived as a human being on earth that went through these sorts of things, real bodily suffering on earth. So even the Epistle to the Hebrews requires that.
If Hebrews had said that, there would be no debate. But if we read, like, in Philippians, for example, where Jesus is a pre-existent being who takes on basically a humble form on purpose and undergoes great suffering and therefore is exalted, it makes the specific point that he was given the opportunity to take on equality with God and rejected it. So it even refers to the temptation of the celestial being in the celestial state before he became
incarnated.
But you
see, the problem is, I read that, obviously, that famous passage from Philippians, and immediately attribute it to the incarnation of Jesus as a physical human being. Now, why?
In mythicist theory, that is what's going on. It's just not going on Earth. See, that's the thing. Cosmological system. It's happening in a different place.
He takes the form of a slave in that in the Philippian. He takes the form of a slave, and that's the whole point about crucifixion, that it's a slave's punishment. So once again, we come back to the historical event of the crucifixion that's taking place on Earth in the same way that a slave has been crucified. That's what it's saying. It's the lowest of the low. It's not even the lowest heaven. It's right down here in the lowest low on Earth.
Well, it doesn't say that, though. It doesn't say that, though. I mean, that's the thing. That's one way to interpret it, but it's so vague that it can actually be interpreted the other way as well. It could fit the original redaction of the Ascension of Isaiah, or it could fit the Gospel of John. You know, there's it can fit either one. And that's the problem. That's why I think certainty can't be had here, because we don't have a smoking gun either way. And so what we want to look at is, what is the overall best explanation of all of the evidence? And there are certain things that I haven't brought up that haven't come up. And
I'm sure you wouldn't have time, no. But
yeah. Well, I should mention one, because it's not something that you would be likely to ask about or to mention. Mm. The fact that we do have a reference to, in Jewish theology, a pre-existent being named Jesus, who was the firstborn son of God, who was the high priest of the celestial temple, just like Hebrews explains, and was also called the Logos, the word of God. And this is in Philo, who is a contemporary, writing at the same time as Paul. Philo refers to this deity several times. This deity is perhaps the wrong word, but he's an archangel in Philo's vocabulary. who's named Jesus. So there's already this pre-existent firstborn son of God named Jesus, who's the high priest, just like Hebrews says, and so on, already pre-exists Christianity. So there's already this celestial deity going around. So when you, deity again, archangel,
yeah,
it's pagan versus Jewish vocabulary for divine beings. But so you already have this. So when you look at Philippians and you look at that in the context of this pre-Christian Jewish theology of the other Jesus, you can see it in the same sense as the Ascension of Isaiah. The original redaction of the Ascension of Isaiah portrays it. So it does make sense within that context. And I think this is one of the things that it is an obligation upon me to prove and extensively document, and that's what my next book is going to do. And I do think it needs to be done. I don't think it's something that I should just assume everybody understands right out of the gate, and I don't expect people to buy into it until they've seen the documentation and all of this.
Sure. I don't know if you're familiar with any of the documentation referred to there, Mark.
Oh, yes, of course. But, I mean, one has to be ever so careful not to make these sort of big sort of leaps. I mean, Richard is a really intelligent guy, and he's well-read, but the thing is, he has a tendency to make these kind of big leaps all the time into material so that where an analogy is only ever used, it seems to me, in order to try and disprove the historicity of Jesus. And I'm not sure really it's the way that one approaches history. What one has to do is one has to kind of try and get inside the way that Paul, for example, is talking about things. Get inside the way the gospel writers are talking about these things and ask, does this make best sense as people who are talking about a human being who is living within recent history? And each occasion, it makes so much better sense to regard them as talking about a real historical being that was living in recent history. And where lots of the time, in the case of some of the earlier writings, they actually knew people who knew him. They knew his family. They had met these people and ate with them and argued with them. And I think, you know, when Paul had gone down to Jerusalem and chatted with James and Peter, you know, James would have been absolutely horrified, you know, by the idea that the brother that he'd grown up with and eaten fish with didn't actually exist. I think, you know, he would probably be more shocked.
I mean, I'd be interested in hearing from you as well, Mark, of the nature of the literature, say, for instance, the Gospel of Mark. As I understand it, and I have nowhere like the background of either of you guys, but that it's generally seen as falling within a genre of sort of historical biography. Does it strike you as plausible at all that this would not be telling a reason, you know, the deeds of Jesus but rather that it is a retelling of something that happened in a heavenly realm on an earthly plane? Is there another genre of literature that should fall into if it were that, and does it look like that at all from your knowledge of the period?
I mean, it is definitely worth contrasting the canonical gospels plus one or two other non-canonical texts with some of the kind of revelation type discourses that you do get in later Christianity, which are much better suited to talking purely about a celestial being. I mean, the gospels do have very important analogies with the lives, the bioi as they're called, that you find in Greco-Roman literature. But I mean, at the same time, you know, they are gospels. They're kind of propaganda for a particular cause, and of course they're trying to sell Jesus to people. But the point about the Jesus they're trying to sell is that he's a real flesh and blood character, and that is absolutely clear from the message that they're preaching all the way through. They are thoroughly persuaded that the Jesus that they're talking about is a figure in history, and
or they want the readers to be persuaded of this.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, to give an analogy that's kind of outside that actually I think would create more agreement is we look at John, for example, versus Mark and their accounts of the resurrection. And you can trace the development throughout the other Gospels, but you compare the two, John is clearly creating all the evidence he can think of to sort of make it look like Jesus actually rose in the flesh and so on, because he shows his wounds and the discovery of the empty tomb and the discovery of the burial cloths, and he's embellishing the story specifically to sell a particular view of what happened at the resurrection, which I think I would suspect Dr. Goodacre would probably agree is fiction, that he's making that up, that there wasn't really those events particular that John is creating and crafting aren't real, that he's creating those events in order to sell a particular view of Jesus. If you can do that for the resurrection, you can do that for Jesus in general. And I think that's what a lot of the Gospels are doing, especially Luke and John. Mark and Matthew, there can be some debate there, because if you take Mark, for example, his first, when he gives the first parable in Mark, and it's in Mark 4, he immediately has Jesus explain to you in secret, to talking to his disciples, the mystery of kingdom of God is explained, and I'll explain what the parables mean, but to the public, I say everything in parables to conceal the truth from them. And that, in a sense, is kind of a clue to what the whole thing of Mark is. And this is what John Dominic Crossan's latest book, The Power of Parable, argues, is that the Gospels are extended parables, that they're parables about Jesus, not just parables from Jesus. And I think that if you see it in that sense, you can see Jesus is being used to sell a particular doctrine. And then once you start doing that, it becomes more and more useful to actually insist that that was a real historical Jesus.
I mean, we can have a debate, Mark, I suppose, about the extent to which John embellishes and there's additions and whatnot. But I suppose the question for me is, are those what we call synoptic accounts fiction from the start, you know, something that where they've literally thought this stuff up about this character Jesus to put him in this kind of earthly historical plane as opposed to this heavenly realm? I have to confess, I'm having trouble buying that. But
well, that'll be my next book. No, I mean, in all honesty, in all sincerity, that I do think that this is something that requires a lot of preparation and background and explanation, and a rigorous presentation of the logic, why the conclusion follows. Like Dr. Goodacre referred to this, you know, leaps of logic and leaps of assumption. I agree, those are bad. So we want to come up with a way so that if I do that in the formal presentation that will come out next year, that it will be identifiable, and therefore we can say that's the problem with the theory. And so I actually want to see that happen, okay, if it can be done. So that'll be the goal of the next book, is to model and present the argument in all its glory, and then in such a way that if there's flaws in it, they can be easily identified, and then, you know, we can finally move on.
Well, I'll let you respond, because I know you want to, Mark, in the next section, as we're drawing to the end of our time on this part of the program. So you're listening to Unbelievable. As ever, I've got a Christian and non-Christian, but it's not really actually about Christian beliefs per se that we're getting at today. It's really about how do we historically get at the Jesus of the New Testament. Mark Goodacre on the line from Duke University says we really don't have to cast into doubt that we're dealing with a real historical person. Not the view of Richard Carrier, who joins me on the show today. So we're going to hear their final thoughts as they conclude today's program in just a moment's time. This is Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking. Welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking and brings Christians and non-Christians together every weekend here on Premier Christian Radio for dialogue and debate. The final part of today's show in just a moment's time as we conclude the conversation between Richard Carrier and Mark Goodacre. Come back next week, though. Of course, Christmas not far away, just over a week, and we've got a Christmas-themed show for you, of course, on the next edition. And so you're going to be hearing Ben Witherington III, who's a Bible scholar out at Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky, USA. He's going to be debating with Ken Humphreys, who is another Jesus mythicist, actually, perhaps not as well known as Richard Carrier on today's programme. But they're going to be talking about the Christmas narratives. Can we trust them, essentially? Matthew and Luke both tell the Christmas story in different ways. What should we believe? We're going to be hearing their discussion, and Ben Witherington III, I love that name, is going to be defending the reliability of the Christmas narratives. Tune in for that, same time, same place next week. premier.org.uk/unbelievable if you want to find out more, and if you want to listen back to today's programme, send it on to friends, find out about the podcast, the iTunes, and how to get in touch.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, just getting into the final part of today's programme, asking whether Jesus really existed, and we've been hearing the case made by Richard Carrier, one of the world's foremost proponents of the mythicist view that Jesus never existed. His books are available online, of course, and I'll post the links with the podcast of today's programme at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. But Mark Goodacre has been joining us as well, Professor of New Testament at Duke University. Kind of ironic to have the American in England and the Englishman in America this time round, but there you go, that's the way it worked. But Mark, I wanted to ask you that question. I mean, does it just seem utterly implausible to you that this was kind of made up from the start, those synoptic gospels, the accounts of the life of Jesus, or is there something in what Richard says there about some kind of an extended parable is what we're actually witnessing in the gospels?
Well, the thing is, in any writing, and this isn't just ancient writing, of course you have layers and layers of interpretation, and there is no such thing as an unvarnished truth. There's no such thing as an uninterpreted memory. So lots of the time what you've got all of these details, these traditions are refracted through particular people's memories. But the job of the historian is to take all of those traditions as seriously as he or she can, and to kind of penetrate into them and sort of work out what it is that we can say with confidence. And I think we just create so many problems for ourselves if we kind of take the historical Jesus out of the picture altogether. I think we do have to make, and I know that Richard balks when I talk about this kind of thing, but I think we do have to make so many strange leaps if we assume that there is no Jesus in the picture. Probably more than anything else, you can see not just that we've got Jesus in this picture, we've got lots and lots of other characters that are in the story too, and which only hyper-skepticism would cause us to doubt the historicity of. I mean, part of the problem as well, if I can just comment very briefly on the whole nature of doing ancient history, one of our problems is that people only survive insofar as they are remembered by people they made an impact on. So, of course, you're not going to find, you know, coins with historical Jesus on them the same way that we do with Pontius Pilate or kind of any sort of steps with his name, you know, graffitied on by anybody. But the evidence we would expect to find is exactly what we do find, which is Jesus surviving in the memories of those who are closest to him. And of course, those memories are profoundly influenced by all sorts of other things and their own kind of creative things. And there'll be legendary things that kind of come as well. But at the same time, that is exactly the kind of historical evidence we would expect to find it in the memories which become the traditions in that early kind of community. That's what we'd expect to find, and it's what we do find.
Yes, and so you're addressing there the aspect of mythicism, which I don't know whether Richard particularly supports, which is that, oh, well, if we need, yeah, documents and coins like we do for other historical figures of history like Caesar, that's simply not what you're asking for realistically with a character like Jesus. But what we do have is, as you say, what you would expect for a figure of his import and where he lived and all the rest of it at that time. And for you,
it goes quite early. I mean, this stuff goes pretty early. I mean, you know, we've talked, you know, ad nauseum about Paul, but I mean, Paul is pretty early. You know, he's in 40s and 50s when he's writing. He's actually mixing with these characters in the 30s, not long after Jesus's death. So, you know, we're pretty close in time to these characters. Even the writing of the Gospels, we're only talking within a couple of generations or so, the events that they're describing. So pretty close to events.
Yes, in terms of the kind of timescales you're normally talking about with these types of historical figures. Well, for you then, obviously, Mark, you finish up by saying simply the most common sense view, as far as you can see, is to simply assume that we do have a historical character. You take him out and there's just too many problems that then are created by doing that.
I think that's right. I think it becomes tortuous after a while if one pursues the mythicist argument to its logical conclusions. I think there are so many difficult moments in the argument, it just becomes terribly strained. And at the end of the day, you know, sometimes when we're doing history, we have to go for the simplest hypothesis. And the simplest one in this case, the one that explains all the evidence best, is the one that there was a historical figure called Jesus.
Well, I hope you'll pick up a copy of Richard's book and the coming out soon as well. And perhaps you can have another engagement once you've seen the full argument. But
I would very much like that. I mean, I respect Dr. Goodacre's opinion and his ability to analyze evidence. So I think what his response is to my next book, although I would love to see him do a review of my current book as well, although this book, that book doesn't actually argue the thesis
sure.
we've been talking about today.
It kind of sets it up.
It does set it up. But,
I actually agree with some things in Rich's current book, actually, and some of his material about method is exactly right. And, you know, just to to finish myself on a cordial note, I think one of the things that we have to do as historians is we have to be a bit skeptical sometimes, and a skeptical nature is often a very healthy thing. So I like that kind of side of things, but I think that we have to be careful not for that healthy skepticism not to turn into a kind of hyper skepticism.
Sure. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, that is often the way people talk about you as among the hyper skeptics
on this one issue. This
issue. I mean, for you, you've obviously come to the considered opinion that this is the best explanation overall, taking every factor into account.
But it isn't. It's interesting because Dr. Goodacre did refer to like the one correct point, and as you mentioned as well, that the mere absence of evidence is not sufficient to argue for the non-existence of Jesus, and that is hyper-skepticism. If you say, "Well, we don't have coins," you know, I did a talk for Skepticon just this last weekend, where I use an example of the Glycon cult, where we actually have coins stamped of the god with the god's image on it, who was incarnated on Earth within his supposed lifetime.
Yeah.
So we have things like that, but we don't have any particular reason to expect that to have occurred for Jesus. So the idea that the absence of evidence in that respect suggests Jesus didn't exist is not a valid argument, because we can explain that evidence just as easily on historicity, as long as we accept that the Gospels hugely exaggerate his fame. So as long as we're willing to accept that he was a more obscure, lesser-known person, which is easy to accept as a plausible historical theory of how Christianity began, that he was not famed across all Syria, that kind of thing that the Gospels say about it. So there are ways to build plausible historicity theories. But the question is, you have to look at all of the evidence. But I think the problem is that there's problems with that evidence, with the evidence on that theory as well. There's problems either way. So it's not a question that mythicism creates problems. I think mythicism is an attempt to solve certain problems that are already created by the historicity theory and its difficulty in explaining a lot of the evidence. However, that's a case that I have to make. And so we'll see how that proceeds in the coming years.
Well, thank you for coming in and talking to us about it today, Richard. And Mark, thank you very much for being available from Duke University. And if people want to find out more about you and your work, do you want to just give the website that they should go to?
Oh, sure. You could go to probably the thing people would most enjoy would be my podcast, which is called the NT Pod. Just Google for NT Pod, or go to podacre.blogspot.com, or just get to iTunes.
Yeah, absolutely. So check that out. And Mark podcasts on all kinds of issues in New Testament history there. And equally, if people want to find out more about your own writings and research, you've got a website as well, haven't you, Richard?
Yes, www.richardcarrier.info.
Okay, well, there's the place to go, and I'm of course going to post those links with the podcast of this program at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. For now, thank you very much again, gents, for being with me, and thank you for listening. And if you'd like to get in touch, then why not drop me an email to unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll be reading out some of your comments on last week's program in a short moment's time. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to get in touch and respond to anything you've heard on today's programme, I'd be happy to receive your emails as usual. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We do have a phone number as well, and I can play out recorded messages. I haven't had a lot of those recently, but if you want to do that, it's 08456 52 52 52. And select the option to leave a voicemail for Unbelievable. You can also, of course, get in touch via the social media aspects of the show. You can find me on Twitter, @UnbelievableJB. There's also the Facebook page if you search for Unbelievable on Facebook, or go to facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And a number of you getting in touch in the last week via Twitter. We've had some fascinating shows recently. And last week was Philip Pullman and Francis Spufford talking about Francis Spufford's new book, Unapologetic. They were discussing whether Christianity makes emotional sense, and a fascinating discussion between them both. Well, Philip Pullman, very well known, obviously, as a novelist, as an author. Francis Spufford, equally respected by Philip Pullman for the work he's done, but the first time he's written specifically on Christianity. So a number of you enjoyed that, but had some questions nonetheless. People like Nick, who said, I thought the programme was very interesting, but I was a bit exasperated at what Pullman said. I think Francis didn't answer him well. For instance, Pullman said Jesus thought the end of the world was coming in his lifetime, and certainly nothing like the kingdom of God came within a generation. Well, as an orthodox preterist, I think he's entirely misreading the text. Jesus did not predict the end of the world, but the end of the age. The next age, that of the Messiah, was to come. The danger is reading the Olivet Discourse in a wooden, literal sense. Also, many of the ethics of Jesus were for his time in various ways, though there are applicational principles for us. For instance, turning the other cheek was in line with the Roman habit of a personal insult by a slap of the cheek. It was saying to end the cycle of retaliation to Rome instead of to be a zealot. It didn't mean to be a doormat. Thank you very much, saying you're looking forward to today's show as well when you sent that in. Here's also Seth, who makes essentially the same point as Nick just did, says he enjoyed the interaction a lot but couldn't help being frustrated when Philip Pullman asserted Jesus was essentially a false prophet for predicting the end of the world. Neither you nor Francis answered that point. If we take a futurist approach to prophecy, there's some juggling that has to happen to explain it. But if you take, as I do, the partial preterist position, Jesus wasn't predicting the end of the world but the fall of Judea, which did happen in the first century. So far from being a point against Jesus as a prophet, it's a point in his favour. You also went on to say in your email, Seth, Philip's point was straight out of Bertrand Russell's writings, and it wasn't valid then. It still isn't. I was just shocked. Neither you nor Francis seemed able to rebut it. Obviously, in the context of the discussion we were having, which was quite wide-ranging, it's not always easy to come back on every point. And the focus, obviously, overall wasn't on the question of whether Jesus was a false prophet or not, though I appreciate it can be frustrating when issues come up which don't really get responded to within the course of a programme. We have done programmes specifically on that subject, though, if you look back through the archives of the Unbelievable podcast. Thank you very much, though, for getting in touch. Derek, who's an atheist, emailing, said a very good-natured discussion between Francis Spufford and Philip Pullman. I often hear Christians referring to the church as a flawed human institution, as Francis did. Of course, there is little choice, as it has had such a checkered history. However, if God were real and the church were made up of people in touch with God, wouldn't we expect it to be rather special? Should we not be able to compare it with other human institutions and say, gosh, this really is something different, like a lamp on a stand, the light of the world? Says Derek, well, maybe we should, but at the same time, I don't think there's anything in Scripture that suggests that becoming a Christian means you're absented from the usual struggles of being a human, and that's inevitably going to, you know, be passed on to the institution that we form, known as the church. I mean, even those heroes of the faith, St. Peter denied his master three times, didn't he? Anyway, thank you very much for getting in touch, and we've had quite a few coming in on that. This is from Nick, who says, man, you guys have really stepped up your game lately. Guys, it's just me, Nick, it's just me. But thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I've really enjoyed the last few shows, especially the one on the moral argument and the one from this last week with Philip Pullman and Francis Spufford. What a love fest that was. I love thinking that you guys will leave the debate and get a pint together. I usually only feel like this unless David Robertson is on. But on this week, I imagine that all three of you went for one. Keep the good work up. I can't believe you guys still offer this as a free podcast. I would totally pay. I cannot wait for the Richard Carrier debate next week. God bless you. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate your sentiments there. And you can take me out for a pint sometime if you like. Okay, let's talk about the show that went out on podcast, at least before that, was the Alex Gabriel and Peter Hitchens debate on whether the UK will be better off when it stops being a Christian country. As I mentioned last week, lots of response to that, a lot of it aimed at the way that Alex Gabriel, the atheist contributor, sort of made his points. So we had a number of emails on that. They've still been coming in. So let's just have a quick one from Robert Fisher here, who says, though I'm a devout atheist, I must confess I did something I never did before with respect to your podcast. After listening to about a minute of Alex Gabriel's opening statements in the debate with Peter Hitchens, I hit stop and deleted the podcast. Why Oxford would host a debate between someone like Peter Hitchens and a petulant child like Gabriel is beyond me. It would have been more edifying to fly in Be Strong. Anyone who's listened back a while to Unbelievable will know who Robert's referring to there. You say it would have been more edifying to fly him in to debate Hitchens, or perhaps James Croft, although he's from Cambridge, but has always seemed to me to stick to the issues and behaved like a civilized human being. Perhaps Alex was unwittingly brought on to serve as Exhibit A, i.e. his opening statement would serve to corroborate Hitchens' opening statement that secularism leads to a degradation of moral principle and moral practice. Over the years, I've gradually observed this unfortunate trend that secularism has not been causing people to behave in a more civilized way or to think in a more sophisticated, accurate ways. And Gabriel is only the most recent evidence of this. Have you ever considered having a conservative atheist like S.E. Cupp on your show? There are some of us out there. Cheering on Christianity is not a position I've always held, but empirical evidence, like that demonstrated by Gabriel or P.Z. Myers, has driven me to this position over the years. Of course, I believe I have rational grounds for thinking atheism is true, and anecdotal evidence does not and cannot change this, but I find it depressing that atheists seem to be devolving rather than evolving, and that this perhaps is the reason why religious belief would be a positive evolutionary characteristic in the first place, and hence so widespread. I wonder what Van Til would make of that. Thank you very much, Robert. And there have been a number of interesting online responses as well to that debate that was aired here on the programme. Originally took place, though, in Oxford, organised as not, as it were, officially by Oxford University, but organised by students at Oxford University as a sort of extracurricular activity. So don't write to the authorities at Oxford University complaining about it if you didn't enjoy that debate. Thank you very much for getting in touch anyway. Let's talk about morality, which was the subject of the previous show. Angus Ritchie was debating Kyle Jones, and Angus Ritchie making the case that, I'll try and boil this down, but that if there is such a thing as moral realism, that there are real objective moral facts out there, then it's highly unlikely that an unguided evolutionary process would track those real moral values, and hence, if we accept evolution, it must be a guided process to track the morality that many people believe is objectively true. So Dewey Jones wants to say, what makes Angus Ritchie think natural selection can't create values through instinct? He didn't say. He only said, I think we can agree. And Kyle Jones obligingly did agree. I don't know why. Instincts as a source of values and a guide to behaviour have been demonstrated in many experiments. For example, there was a study that showed that children in a kibbutz in Israel who were brought up in creches, though they weren't related by blood, were not very likely to marry once they had grown up. It appears that some instinct activated while they were young and growing up together made them loathe in later years to consider each other as partners. You can't very well say that was from God. Why would God not want them to marry if they weren't really related? But it does make sense if that's the work of blind instinct. So you go on to say, instinct, after all, may be the absolute you're looking for. Introspection is vital. That's the subjective element. But as we all share the same instincts, as long as they don't get twisted and distorted, there is an objective element in ethics too, even though there may be no God to lay down the rules and impose his standard on the rest of us. I don't know, Kyle. I don't know if you've understood really what the argument was getting at. It's not saying that we can't have instincts that may tie in with our natural, our moral views. But the question is, if morality is purely a non-purposed process of, a random process of evolution, then the only kind of morality that it can, go with that is of the subjective sort. But given that many people do want to affirm a moral objectivism, a moral realism, as Angus put it, then there is no good reason to think that the moral faculties we have via evolution would track the truth of the moral realism itself. I have discovered since doing that show that the booklet of Angus's article is actually available of his argument. So you might want to go and check that out. Just type in Angus Ritchie Theos, who made the booklet available, and you should find a link for the download of that. And it might kind of give a bit more meat to that. But anyway, thanks for getting back in touch, and thanks to all those who have been in touch in one way or another. Lorraine, Laura, Avril, Alistair, and others who I haven't had time to read out emails from today, but perhaps next week. Thank you for listening today. Come back again next week here on the show that aims to try and get you thinking. Don't forget to email me and let me know what you thought of today's programme. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you do come back same time next week, here's what you'll be hearing.
You're unbelievable.
Well, Christmas will almost be upon us, and so time for the usual festive Christmas edition of the show, and we'll be looking at something we've done before but I think is worth revisiting. Can we trust the Christmas narratives? We'll be looking at the way that Luke and Matthew write their story of the birth of Jesus and the various events that surround it. And Ben Witherington III from the United States will be defending those accounts, and we'll be hearing a response from skeptic Ken Humphreys. So join me for that, same time, same place, next week, here on the show that aims to get you thinking, Unbelievable. Until then, have a very pleasant week.